follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Welcome to New Horror Express, your, at this precise moment, monthly, but hopefully soon to be once again fortnightly podcast, chatting to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and on today's show, I'm talking to writer-director Rob Jabaz about his debut feature, The Sadness, a film that is one of the goriest you're ever likely to see, and will undoubtedly end up being one of the most talked about horror movies of 2022. Over the course of the interview, I talked to Rob about whether he was ever worried about pushing the violence too far, the opposing reactions to the film in Taiwan and on the festival circuit, and about those gore effects. Plus, we get into classic zombie movies, the influence of Garth Ennis' Cross comic book series, and what he might be working on next. All of which you can hear right now in my interview with Rob. Hi Rob, welcome to the show.
Hey, what's up? How you doing?
So we've got you on the show today to talk to you about your film, The Sadness. And I generally start all my interviews this week. Oh, can't speak today. This way.
go on.
The first question I normally ask is, can you give a brief spoiler-free synopsis for the audience of your film, The Sadness?
Yeah, okay. The film is about a virus that turns people into homicidal sex perverts. And it's pretty much just the story of kind of like the first day that that happens, and a man and a woman, a young couple, they go off on their daily routine. She goes to work, and he kind of works from home, and so they're separated, and then this crazy sort of situation happens, and the next thing you know, they're fighting for their lives, trying to get back to each other. So like the plot is actually very simple. It's just about sort of two people trying to reconnect amongst all of this, horrible depravity and murder and savagery in the streets. And that really is the meat of the film is the violence and sort of this nightmare world of just everybody turning into a homicidal sex pervert. And so there's lots of violence and depravity and it's a horror movie in the truest sense of the word.
And so on that little synopsis, one of the first things that came into my mind is, was the initial script written pre-pandemic, or did you write this in 2020?
No, it was written because of the pandemic.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me elaborate. I'll just say that the script was written because we had this situation where Taiwan wasn't terribly affected by COVID-19. It was managed really effectively early on. And we were in sort of a position here. I was, the studio that I work for, they were just like, you know what, if we make a movie right now, we're not going to really have any competition because everything else is closed and we're open for business. So let's write something really quick about, maybe it should be about a pandemic because that seems to be what's on everyone's mind right now. Mm-hmm. So let's do something about a pandemic. And then my financer, his head first went to oh yeah, zombie movie. And I said, okay, but maybe we can take it to the next level. Maybe we can, you know, juice it up a little bit and make it more extreme. And so I, you know, tried my hand at doing that. And next thing you know, we had a script and we just went right ahead and shot it. And then we put out the movie like by January the next year in Taiwan. And then we kind of sat on it for a few months and then entered it into sort of all the genre festivals internationally. And that's kind of where everybody around the world is hearing about it. That's probably where you heard about it too. I know that we are playing at the New Zealand film festival. I can't remember the exact name of the film festival, but I think it's like the New Zealand International Film Festival.
That's absolutely correct. It's called the New Zealand International Film Festival, which is just starting as we record, but will have been the month before by the time this episode goes out. Yeah, I was wondering as well, you know, given that synopsis, one of the things I thought about was, are you at all aware of the comic book series Crossed?
Oh yeah, for sure. Absolutely. That was a huge inspiration for the film.
So it was because I, you know, a lot of the times, you know, sometimes I, you know, see what could possibly be an inspiration and I ask the film director and they're like, no, I've never heard of that. What's that about? And I'm like, oh, it's quite something.
Yeah.
But no, that was like a direct inspiration for the film.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the way I see it, it's kind of like, you know, like there's no, like there's, it's sort of all kind of in the cultural, like on the cultural buffet table, like at the cultural salad bar, you know, like, for example, you know, the monsters that exist in like the Lost Boys, like modern vampires are also in Fright Night and they're also in Dracula and stuff, you know, and the monsters that exist in The Walking Dead are the same ones that exist in Dawn of the Dead and Night of the Living Dead. You know? So I just figure like, you know, if you, whatever, you know, like these things get added to sort of the cultural salad bar and we want to see them doing stuff. And I just figured, fuck, you know, I mean, this is some pretty cool stuff. I'm going to put this on the screen, but at the same time, you know, you can't in good conscience just take it and rip it off. Like you have to write your own story around it. And also you have to, you know, sort of, the thing is with, I mean, there's a reason why, in my opinion, there's a reason why Crossed was never made into like any kind of TV show or movie, is just because it's way too extreme, you know, way, way too extreme. So what I did was I kind of took the things that I thought were interesting about it and focused on those things. And the things that I thought were interesting was just the kind of this idea that, like, you know, you're aware and you're cognizant of what you're doing while you're infected, because that really is the thing about zombie movies that makes it kind of not scary. And it's also kind of what makes it fun in a way. And let me explain. So it's kind of not that scary because there's no malice. Like zombies are just brainless and they're just kind of walking at you, just trying to bite you. And the way that it's fun is that from the side of like the human characters, there's no remorse or no moral quandary when it comes to killing them. Like you can walk around with a machine gun and just you know, blow all their heads off and not feel, and you know, if you're sitting there watching a movie, you can sit there and eat popcorn and feel totally justified morally, because it's just like, whatever, they're zombies, you know, they're already dead. So it kind of in a way lowers the stakes, the emotional stakes. But if you have actual thinking, talking people, but they're just like maniacs, then all of a sudden everything changes, right? So I just figure, fuck it, you know, like this idea is too good just to kind of leave alone. You know, I have an opportunity here to make a film and I'm just gonna make this film and try to actually make this genre scary again, you know. Mm-hmm. Give it a new shot of life.
I suppose it's a different type of scare, isn't it? I suppose, like, traditionally the fear fact, I mean, I would say, you know, there is certain situations, particularly when it comes to like kind of kids zombies and zombie films and stuff like that, there is a kind of emotional element. But I suppose, like, the fear factor comes less from the, you know, what you were describing, and more from the being just this mass, you know, is just the kind of relentless inescapability of it.
The situation. Absolutely.
That's where.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. No, I agree with you 100%. I mean, I think that you feel that the most in maybe like Day of the Dead, you know, where it's like, you know, we're the last ones left and we're hiding underground. And, you know, for all we know, the entire planet is just covered in the walking dead, the living dead. And that kind of just, you know, that kind of like takeover aspect, and just like, you know, like you said, like sort of hordes and hordes, and kind of this, there's no way out, there's no escape, and all we can really do is just kind of hide until we run out of food and die, that aspect of it. But I mean, if we're being realistic, like that these kinds of ideas are kind of, you know, they're like zombie films these days, or zombie media these days is not really about that, you know. It's not really about those kinds of ideas. It's just about like feeling morally justified going around and killing people. And it kind of also plays to sort of this sort of American libertarian kind of idea of you know, like prepping for a disaster and
yeah, right. Okay. Bunkering, you know what I mean? Down somewhere in the middle of Alaska yourself in the shack.
Yeah, yeah. And having your guns and having your supplies and being able to, like, you know, like being able to sort of be independent and handle your own stuff. And that, like, I think it really appeals to that aspect of certain people.
Which is so ironic. So I was just thinking, which is ironic given the kind of, I mean, not the origins of the genre, because the origins of the genre are like the old kind of like white zombie, like, you know, voodoo films, but like
I would disagree with that though.
Well,
yeah. Okay. So, I don't mean to cut you off, but I think that the modern zombie does start with Night of the Living Dead.
Like, yeah, no, that's what I was going to say. So what I was going to say is ironic, because even though the original origin of the zombie subgenre comes from that, the modern zombie subgenre starts with Night of the Living Dead. And, you know, the irony there about some of the more recent, you know, leaning towards what you're saying about the American libertarianism thing, is because of the Romero stuff has very clearly kind of liberal leftist outlook, and it's about social commentary and on America and American militarism and American consumerism and American racism.
Yeah, I think also, I mean, I've thought a lot about, like, I know, you know, because it's really easy to sort of attribute kind of like meaning to things kind of after the fact, you know. Like, I mean, for example, I just talked with some people a little while ago about how about the movie The Fly, the David Cronenberg film The Fly, mm-hmm. and the guy that I was talking to kept trying to ascribe sort of like meaning to the you know, like the fly disease. He was trying to tell me that it related in some way to like AIDS, like to the AIDS crisis of the 80s. And it's right. Just like, I don't really think that's what it's about. And I think that that's just sort of incidental because of just sort of what was happening at the time. But I do think that you're hitting the nail right on the head when you're talking about, like, you know, like, I don't think that George Romero was just trying to make sort of like a pulpy, scary movie. He definitely was trying to say stuff, especially with, but I think it's less about sort of like broad scale social things and more about sort of smaller scale stuff, like how it's really difficult for like people to kind of work together in a crisis. And like for example, in the original Night of the Living Dead, you got Cooper and his family in the basement, and you have Ben and Barbara up top, and all they have to do is just work together. All they have to do is just sort of, you know, be civil and work together, but they just can't seem to do that. And it's their inability to kind of work together that causes the ultimate downfall of everybody. Right. And then as far as Dawn of the Dead is concerned, people always say that too. It's about, you know, consumerism and stuff. But I mean, when you watch that film, I'd say that the message is pretty just sort of obtuse, you know, like it's not really like a very deep message. It's not really like a very nuanced message. It's just kind of like, okay, like consumers are like zombies. Got it. You know, like you could say it so quickly.
Yeah. I mean, as like, I think that is a big difference. Like, I mean, he did, Romero, like Carpenter, you know, like the satirical stuff is pretty obvious, but it kind of still works. But like, it's not like, because you know, you were talking about the guy talking about The Fly, and Cronenberg, right. Like Lynch is one of those filmmakers who makes films kind of open-ended and never like ascribes particular meaning to his films, right. But I think like there is, it's very definite, you know, when it comes to like the Dead trilogy, just like it's very definite when you watch like the likes of They Live. And, you know, it's, again, it's not exactly a subtle kind of satire that you have to kind of look for.
Right, not at all.
Dig into the meaning. It's pretty surface level, but it still kind of works.
Right. Yeah, that's the word I was looking for. I was looking for surface level. But like, I mean, I guess maybe kind of what I'm driving at is that, like, you know, a lot of people kind of, how do you say, they started to kind of make connections between sort of like the civil rights movement I think it was 68 when Night of the Living Dead came out.
Night of the Living Dead, yeah.
And they were kind of like, oh yeah, you know, like, you know, the casting of a black actor for Ben, Romero is obviously making some sort of statement here, and very famously, you know, oh no, this guy who just happened to be the best actor is what Romero said. But then again, like, you know, you look at sort of the opening scene, the project scene in Dawn of the Dead, where they go in and they the SWAT team goes in and starts just, you know, trying to drive out all of those the residents of that project, you know.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
there's
yeah,
a
yeah,
very clear, very very clear
yeah yeah
yeah very clear like racism thing there. And then, you know, obviously that's actually how what's the name, it's Roger and the other Peter. Guy, the black guy, what's his name, Peter, that's
Peter.
Right, Roger and Peter meet each other because of that guy who is killing everybody, who blows up that guy, blows up his head in the room, yep. When he opens up the door, yep. That's actually how they become friends and how they sort of respect one another. So like, there's absolutely a lot more of a social commentary message in Dawn of the Dead, 100%. That's maybe even the strongest one. The consumerism one, maybe is, I guess, a little less nuanced. And that I always just thought that it was never that strong when I watched Dawn of the Dead, even as a younger guy. But anyways, I'm happy talking about other films. I talk about my films so fucking much, but I love just talking about like other movies. So, but we can go on. Let's just go down your line of questions.
Well, you know, I'm always happy to talk about Dawn of the Dead or any of the Dead trilogy. Dawn of the Dead, particularly, I have a great fondness for. It's one of my favorite horror films.
Yeah, it's a really great movie. I remember the first time that I saw that, it was really life changing. It felt like I was watching like a really important piece of like film history. I think I must have been like 12 or something. Really, really, but it felt important. You know, felt like this is it. I'm actually seeing Dawn of the Dead. Cool, you know, finally.
I feel very much the same way. I was wanting to go back to your film, and so it sounds like it was a pretty quick turnaround then, in terms of, you were kind of pitched this idea or a pandemic film, obviously, well, last year. How quick was it from script into shooting?
I wrote the script in about maybe 3 weeks or so, and then we did pre-production. Like it was approved like very, very quickly because the money man was just kind of like, he just took a look at the script and he was like, it's pretty good. It could be better, but I mean, if we spend like, let's say if we spend another month on it, like how much better is it going to be? Is it going to be 5% better or 10% better? And I was just like, let's just go with it right now. Let's go with it as is, and we'll make changes kind of like as we go, and he was just like, okay. He just kind of gave me kind of a lot of freedom in that sense. But anyways, we did pre-production over the next 2 months. So April, and then May and June, we did pre-production. April was when the script was written, and then August is when we shot the film. We shot it in 28 days, and then September, October, we did kind of like all the editing, like just cut the film together. I actually cut it together myself. And then what happened after that? Then we also there's a little bit of like visual effects and sort of cleanup that had to be done. I did that myself as well with help from a guy named Logan Sprangers, who I found on Instagram to help me out. And then November, we kind of finalized. Like throughout this entire process, we were also kind of working on the sound. Like I was on the phone every night with, or not on the phone, but like on Zoom or whatever, on Skype, Zoom or Skype with the sound guy and the composer, and we were kind of squaring away what we were doing with the sound and the music and stuff. And then we finalized all that in November, and December we kind of just, crossed all the T's and dotted the I's, and then we were done. And then we just had it in theaters in Taiwan by the end of January, and that was it.
Very quick process then.
Yeah, it was fun. It was a really, I kind of like that. I hear sometimes I hear like you'll hear like a guy like the guy whatever like the guy who directed Dune or whatever, and he'll be like, oh, we spent
Oh,
3 years.
Denis Villeneuve.
Yeah. A fellow Canadian,
Yeah.
fine director. But he's
Yes,
like
indeed.
he's like we spent 3 years developing Dune, and I was like, Jesus Christ, like 3 years doing a movie? That's like that just seems like way too long, So like I like the I like kind of doing stuff fast. I think that it keeps the magic. Although, to be honest, I've only ever done this one film, so what the fuck do I know? I don't have any frame of reference. I only know like what I did the one time I did it.
I mean, like, I do kind of, there's part of me that kind of admires the patience of that, of like doing that over such a long time. I interviewed a guy on the podcast who did an all puppet horror movie called Franken's End, which is really fun, quite
Oh
fun.
yeah.
And
Yeah, I didn't actually see that myself.
it took him 6 years to make that movie because like he was doing most of it himself,
Yeah,
the puppets and
dude,
stuff. It's crazy.
I talk to this guy on like Messenger sometimes. This guy named Morgan King, and he did a film called The Spine of Night, and
Oh,
it's
right.
like
Yeah,
a.
I've been trying to get him on the podcast
Oh
too.
yeah, he's a cool guy. What's cool too is that his brother is also an animator, so it's like this, house full of animators. Well, I guess maybe not house full of animators, but like. I've always thought that would be cool. Like I have two younger sisters, but they totally do different. They're in completely different lines of work than I am. But anyways, I always thought it'd be cool because sometimes you hear that sort of story, like you have like, the Duffer brothers or whatever, and it's like can you imagine like doing a like making a movie like with your brother, like or who's like a similar age as you, and actually like kind of just having like two perspectives, but like you grew up together, so you have all the same references. I think that would just be such a cool situation. But anyways, the point that I'm making is that he spent like 8 years making The Spine of Night, and it's insane because it's not like you know, I mean, obviously like building puppets is hard work and everything, but like he's just rotoscoping. He's just basically at his Wacom tablet, just tracing the whole movie, you know? And so it's this very, very like sort of mechanical, repetitive work that he has to do. And I watched the movie and it's fantastic. It's full of all kinds of crazy ideas and all kinds of like really cool, like little details and stuff. And a lot of like, deep lore, you know? Mm. And, but then at the same time, it's just kind of like, fuck, like, I can't believe that, you know, you and like maybe like five other people did this all like with your two hands, you know? So, I like, for example, like, I just don't know that I could ever do something like that. But at the same time, I mean, sometimes when you're really excited about a project, you know, you're working on it. And the next thing you know, like, holy shit, like, you know, 2 years have gone by of your life and you don't feel fatigued at all. You're still totally invested, you know? So what the fuck, you know, I guess it just depends on like how invested you are in the project.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned a little bit back there that this is your first feature film. Did you find it like in terms of like shooting like a big step up as a director, you know, from doing short films? I know you've done a few shorts. I know you've done animated shorts as well. Was there a big difference or not?
I mean, I feel like I was the only one who didn't think so. Like,
oh, okay.
I for me, it was just kind of like, okay, well, we're, you know, we're doing this, so let's do it. And, you know, I guess I just kind of, you know, I really don't want to, you know, talk shit about anybody or be critical about anybody, because I had a very, very awesome team to help me do this movie. But, at the same time, I definitely, especially during the first like week or so, got a little bit of, pushback just because I had never done it before. And a lot of my team, like, had worked on like productions, like that's what they do. They're all professionals, right? So like, they've all, you know, like, oh, I was the first AD on this movie and this movie. And I worked on this movie and I worked with Rennie Harlan and da 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 da. And I worked with Martin Scorsese one time. Da, da, da. So it's just kind of like, you know, when you're trying to, when you eventually have like a disagreement on how to do something, if you don't sort of stick to your guns, and sort of, you know, willpower your way through, you can kind of allow yourself to be kind of gaslit by that kind of stuff. Like, you know,
yeah.
People kind of make you feel like you don't really, oh, that's not actually how we do this. Like, that's not the right way to do this. And it's just like, well, yeah, well, guess what? Like, we're doing it this way because I know that this is the right way to do it. Like, so yeah, I mean, I always felt like I knew what I was doing. I really did. I really felt like the whole time that I was doing the film, I knew exactly how to do it because I knew that I would be cutting it. So I knew what shots I needed. And I storyboarded the film beforehand, which was, you know, a fucking, you know, if it's anybody out there who's like an aspiring filmmaker, storyboarding your film like ahead of time, thoroughly, like shot by shot, is the best thing you can do, especially if you have a limited budget, because then you sort of know exactly what you need, and there's not really, you know, because time is money, and if you know what you need, then you get it, and then you can get out of there, and you know, you don't waste any money. But yeah, doing all that stuff, I kind of felt like I knew what I was doing, and in the end, you know, like a lot of people thought that it wouldn't come together, and then it did, and then, you know, in Taiwan it didn't really do so well, but I attributed that a lot to marketing, or rather a lack thereof. And then, you know, we waited a few months, put it in the genre festivals, and now The Sadness is like the big fucking festival, the big fucking festival favorite, you know, like in Europe and North America. So I don't know, I seems to be a success outside of Taiwan, but for some reason in Taiwan, it didn't really hit properly. And I think, like I said, it has a lot to do with just people not really, number one, people not really knowing about it. And number two, people not really knowing kind of like what it was. Like the people who went to go see it, I think, were more like expecting something like Train to Busan. It was kind of marketed that way, like the Taiwanese version of Train to Busan. So they, you know, you'd have like grandma going to see the movie, like, oh, I like that spooky Train to Busan movie. And then they're seeing like this extreme horror movie, you know, like this extreme depraved horror movie. And it's just like, this isn't what I want, you know, this isn't what I expected. It's not what I want. So that's kind of how it went down. But I don't really want to dwell on sort of the release in Taiwan too much because,
Of course. That does seem like mismarketing, because obviously Train to Busan, you know, like it was obviously a zombie movie as well, but it's obviously very, very different about a bad dad who becomes a good dad.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah, it really is sort of, what's the word? The purpose of the film, like what it's saying and what it's kind of offering, is much different than what the sadness is, and the audience is much different too. Like the sadness, I don't think really has that kind of breakout. Capability.
Yes, right. That kind of wider, more mainstream appeal.
Absolutely. But at the same time, it seems to be just really satisfying the more orthodox horror fans, you know, like the horror fans who have been in it for a while and they've seen everything, and they're kind of just, you know, a little bit sick and tired of the new wave of like quote unquote elevated horror that doesn't really seem to deliver on a lot of the things that we used to really love about horror, especially like guys who are a little older. How old are you anyway, Scott?
36.
Okay, so you're just a couple years younger than me. I just turned 40 the other day. Like, I turned 40 on Halloween.
Oh, okay. 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 Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you. I did it. I made it to 40. Christ, that's so depressing. And I celebrated my birthday in this fucking quarantine hotel eating cold scrambled eggs.
That's such a shame.
It's all good.
Okay. That's all good. And also, like, away from, you know, the kind of mismarketing in Taiwan, I'm sorry to hear that. But, you know, as a horror fan, it does seem like it is getting great traction at festivals. And your film, you know, in my book, and I'm sure in a lot of horror fans' book, has played all of the coolest festivals. It's been in the UK, it's been at Fright Fest and Grim Fest. In the US, it was at Fantastic Fest. In Canada, it was at Fantasia. In Spain, it was at Stitches. These are all the very top horror, cult and fantasy festivals. So it's going great guns there.
Yeah. I mean, and it's not only is it just going to those festivals, it's like winning awards. Like I won like best feature and best director at Fantastic Fest. And at Fantasia, I won best first feature
or something.
The New Flesh Award for best first feature. Grim Fest gave me the audience award. The TO Horror Festival in Turin gave me the audience award. And what else? Oh, yeah, also the Brooklyn Horror Film Festival gave me the audience award. Lots of audience awards. It seems to be a real crowd pleaser. So, I ain't bragging. I'm just telling you the facts here. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, for sure. It does seem to be definitely hitting a nerve with horror fans. It does seem to be a lot of the reaction is like it's one of those kind of perfect midnight movies. One of the things, you know, obviously in all of the reviews, the thing that has been noted is like the extremity of it, the extremity of the violence. Was there any point in the production you were thinking like, oh, well, maybe I won't do that. Maybe this is pushing it too far.
Not at all. I mean, there actually is quite a lot of restraint in the film. And I think that that's kind of a double-edged. I just watched a review by someone who saw it at Beyond Fest. And the guy's like, okay, I thought it was like a pretty good movie, but like, you know, why didn't they, like the part where like the girl is getting assaulted, like how come they didn't like show more of it? Like that's not too extreme. Like you hear all these things about the movie being so extreme, And then they're not even going to like show that stuff. Like, you know, like he's completely missing the point of what I'm trying to do, you know, because that's to kind of go really graphic with sort of sexual violence stuff, in my opinion, is usually a mistake unless you're trying to do something very specific. But when you're doing a movie kind of in the context of like the sadness, it's like you don't want to, you want to keep the terror, but you don't want to like rub the audience's nose in sort of like the ugliness of like rape and sexual assault and stuff, right? Because that's a really, really good way to make the audience just completely turn against you. And it's not, I have to be very clear about this. It's not a matter of kind of like sparing the audience trauma. It's a matter of like making sure that people walk out of the film feeling like they are on the side of the film, and then when they want to go back to their computer and they want to review the film, well, favorably, you know. So it's a little bit cynical, but at the same time, you know, to be 100% sort of like audience hostile is not hard to do. You know, I could revolt you if I absolutely wanted to, but to kind of strike a balance between sort of something that's a little bit, or even a little bit more than a little bit, abrasive and something that's actually genuinely entertaining, I think is kind of the tone that I tried to strike with the sadness. So you'll find, all you viewers out there, when you watch the film, you'll find that, you know, very much in the same way that the Texas Chainsaw Massacre often has this reputation of being very gory, but if you actually watch the film, it's not gory at all. Like, there's not, you know, really a drop of blood spilled throughout the whole film. Maybe there is a couple drops, but it's actually not a gory film at all. It's just kind of like the vibe and the tone that kind of makes you feel like you're watching something more cruel than you actually are watching. And I think that's kind of the same thing that happens with the sadness. The ideas and the themes that are being dealt with are very nasty, but the actual things that are shown are not extreme in a way that not extreme in a way that I think are in the realm of bad taste. But also let me be very clear about the fact that there absolutely is a lot of gore and graphic violence in the sadness. I just tried to be very sensitive to the more sexual aspects of it, sexual violence aspects of it.
Yeah, I think, I mean, yes. I very much agree with you and your point there about it's particularly if you're making a film that you want to be an entertainment or like an entertaining film, that generally it, sexual violence in any sort of explicit way is to be avoided. Unless your film, I think basically unless your film is actually, unless you're making something like Irreversible, unless your film is actually about sexual violence, and that's the whole point of it, it should not be something that's thrown into a movie.
Like with Irreversible, like, I mean, you know, the reason why that's an effective use of graphic sexual violence isn't because that film is about sexual violence. Like, I mean, one could make the argument that, you know, my film is about, you know, sexually violent zombies or whatever, you know. I mean, that's mm-hmm. that's kind of the elevator pitch for the sadness, I guess, if you want to be kind of reductive about it. But in terms of Irreversible, I think that the reason why it's you know, kind of why it's appropriate for that film is because that film is kind of designed to harm the audience. That film
it's
is
not made as an entertainment, as it's designed, right? Yes. You have to make it kind of grounded, and like it has to come from a different angle. You can't be like, I'm going to try and make an entertaining film and like, but then just throw in a random rape scene.
Right. Let me give you a for instance, like a good example of like sort of really poorly handled sexual violence is like in the the later entries of the Wrong Turn series, like Wrong Turn 3, 4, 5.
Right.
Like,
yes.
Those are just like, cause the thing is that you're not really horrified by them. You're just kind of rolling your eyes. You're just kind of being like, fuck this. You know, like the audience is not being revolted. They're just turning off. They're just like, you're losing them. You're losing them. They're not paying attention anymore because it's just seems in the very truest sense of the word, it's gratuitous. There's no need for this. You're just kind of trying to be edgy or disruptive, but it's largely unsuccessful because those entries in the series are just so what's the word, like they just reek of just effort, you know, like just trying so hard to get a reaction out of the audience. And so yeah, that's my example of sort of when that's sort of my example of like what not to do or what I tried to avoid when doing this act.
Yeah, because I mean we talked earlier about like Crossed being like an inspiration on the film. Mm-hmm. And I feel like there's certain, Garth Ennis is a good writer and stuff, and but there is also a big strain in comic books that particularly came after Watchmen and stuff like that by people who don't have the same writing ability as people like Garth Ennis and Alan Moore, who just seem like, and again, like you say with the Wrong Turn stuff, it's like that very kind of adolescent, like, I'm just throwing this out there because right. I'm like so shocking and edgy and like, is this too exactly. challenging for you? It's like, no, it's not too challenging for me. It's just, you're an idiot and you're trying to shock me and you just leave me alone.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like, this is kind of like, in a way, kind of how I think a lot of people felt when the Rob Zombie Halloween movies came out, the misinterpretation was that like by defenders of that movie is that like, oh, you know, you guys just can't handle this hardcore movie. And it's like, no, it's not that we can't handle it. We just kind of think it's sort of dorky and it's sort of adolescent and it just feels stupid. And, you know, that's basically the long and short of it. I should say also, like, you know, when you actually read Crossed, especially like the original Cross, like the first arc, if you were asked kind of like what is Crossed about in terms of like thematics, it really is about kind of the same thing that a lot of the zombie, like the modern zombie stuff is about, like The Walking Dead as well. It's kind of like how do we kind of hang on to our humanity and how do we hang on to civilization in the face of just hell on earth, you know, like sort of to take that a step further, like how horrible do we have to become in order to survive in a hell on earth, you know, like that really is sort of the thesis of Crossed is, yeah. In my opinion. The sort of the background, like sort of the premise of it is it's a pretty kind of original and kind of creative premise to kind of just center the entire series around. But if you look at Crossed, that really is what it's saying, I think, like ultimately. And it's it really is a cool comic, like beyond the sort of adolescent kind of aspects of it, you know, like, oh, like Horsecock, you know, or whatever the fucking character is, the guy who walks around with a severed horse cock or whatever.
Yeah.
It's really good. And there's definitely kind of a lot to take from it. But really, I mean, if we're being honest, Crossed really is about like just the gore and the covers. Crossed has the best covers. They remind me of like a Cannibal Corpse album covers or something.
Yeah, you know, they kind of do. Yeah, I think, and like you say, yeah, I don't think probably your film's the closest thing to a representation of something close to that idea. Because, I mean, I was surprised that both Preacher and The Boys were made into TV shows. So, I don't think we will see any crossed feature or TV series anytime.
You never know, man. I mean, like maybe they just needed someone to take to make that first step forward, you know? Like maybe it was kind of like 28 Days Later needs to happen so the Dawn of the Dead remake can happen, you know?
Yeah, no, that's true. That's true. And I suppose like, yeah, I mean like, I suppose if a big name wants to do it, you know, like, cause I think the Preacher series ended up getting made because like, I think Seth Rogen like co-wrote it or something. Like Seth Rogen's definitely involved.
He was probably a fan.
Yeah. No, I think he is. So that's how that got me. And I'm not sure about The Boys, but you never know, I suppose. You never know.
I'm just speculating. Probably The Boys just kind of probably just took off because like when did that thing come out? Like The Boys probably came out what, like 2010 or something like that, a little earlier.
Yeah. So comics.
The comics, sure.
Yeah,
but I mean,
something like that. Probably.
So it's been sitting around for a while. It's probably just it got optioned like early on, and then eventually like when The Watchmen came out and sort of like people sensed that there was sort of like a superhero fatigue happening a little bit. And they maybe sort of an anti-superhero themed kind of piece of content would hit with people in a certain way. And sure enough, it did. I think actually, to be honest, I think that The Boys TV show is better than the comic. I think that sort of there are certain ways that they tie things together that are a little more elegant in terms of like themes, technology and stuff.
Yes. I actually would agree with you. I think The Boys TV series is slightly better than the comic. I think the way that the kind of soups are presented is they're kind of, I mean, in the comic they're kind of for the most part kind of gleefully evil, whereas they're a little bit more rounded in the TV show, and there are certain things that are kind of handled. Particularly Starlight's arc is kind of, I think, kind of handled better in the TV show than the comic as well.
Right. Also, you got to think too, like social media was a lot different back when Garth Ennis was writing it. So like the way that they kind of tie that all in and kind of make it more modern, like it actually serves the story better. Like kind of having the whole sort of social media kind of infrastructure, like all that stuff, like it really kind of feels like, oh yeah, that's probably how this would be if this were real, you know, like it works works really in favor of the story.
For sure. But I didn't think we'd get here, but like we did. I was wondering in terms of like your festival run, I was wondering how many. I mean, you must have got to a few festivals since you're in the quarantine hotel. How many festivals did you manage to get to in person?
Oh God, I can't really remember. Probably like around like 7 or 8 or something. Yeah, it's pretty good. And what's nice about that is that when you go to all these festivals, publications that do these sort of like, what are the best festivals to what are the best genre festivals to go to? They actually come and they put you on the panel to like rate festivals. Yeah. So I hope that people will see me on that panel, and then next year or the year after they'll give me better hotel rooms.
Okay, cool. What were your favorite? Do you have any either favorite festivals or favorite kind of memories from a festival, whether it be like the audience reaction or particular fan interaction you had or whatever?
I'll tell you that just which are my favorite like festivals. Like, I mean,
sure.
Like Fantasia is kind of my number one festival in Montreal. Mm-hmm. It's just like I probably wouldn't even be like a filmmaker if it hadn't been for Fantasia, because I actually used to go to that festival as a fan when I was a teen. So that kind of really introduced me to like a lot of like I first saw Street Trash at Fantasia, and I first saw like the Ebola Syndrome at Fantasia. So it was really cool to like, you know, be kind of honored at this festival that kind of was so influential in like, I guess, like my formative years. And then I also really like, what else? You know, what's one that I should mention that I really liked was the Calgary International Film Festival in Canada. I felt like the people who ran that festival really kind of like more than any other festival that I went to this year. They really kind of made me feel like they were glad I was there, and they set it up so that there was always something to do. Like there was always sort of like a little function or like a lunch or like a happy hour. And mm-hmm. You're never just kind of, cause you're just a lot of times, like, I mean, you're just traveling solo, right? Like, I mean, it's especially with the pandemic and stuff, like a lot of the people who worked, pretty much everybody who worked on the film was not vaccinated by the time that we needed to go out to these festivals. I actually had to fly to San Francisco, get vaccinated in the airport, and then fly back to Taiwan, quarantine for 2 weeks, so I'd be ready for going to these festivals, just because like I really wanted to just go, because I've had experiences in the past with like short films where it's like you submit to the festival, but then if you don't go, like nobody pays attention to it. Like you have to be there. You have to kind of talk with people. You have to get your picture taken. You have to do little press things, or else your film just kind of gets lost, you know, in the sea of short films. So I made it my personal business to go to these festivals. And my point is that like you're traveling alone a lot of the time, and you wake up in a hotel and you're just kind of like, okay, well, what the fuck do I do now? You know, just go walk around. You know, what am I going to do? Like walk around and go like window shopping? Like, you know, you don't know anybody there. So it was nice to just sort of have little kind of like functions. Motel X in Portugal was like that too. Like they had like a little sort of filmmaker and industry lounge that was just open like from like 12 o'clock noon to like night. And it was just sort of a little place where you could go and sit down and just drink dollar beers. So, so it was pretty sick. Like I just like that. I kind of like, when the festival sets up a little thing where where you can drink cheap beer. That's all I need.
That's top of the list. Place where other filmmakers can go and cheap beer. That's
all I need.
Excellent.
Because it's not, you know, I met Brian Taylor, one of the directors of Crank and Crank 2, Mom and Dad.
Yeah.
I met him at Fantastic Fest, and so that was actually kind of a cool thing, like, because he really came up and he was just like, damn, like, fuck, man, that movie was sick. I really, really liked it a lot. I'm not really sure exactly what he said. The point is that he liked it a lot, and we talked for like a long time afterwards, and so that was nice. I think I probably made at least like one director friend. I also met Prano Bailey Bond at Sitges, and we chatted a little bit, kind of had a couple laughs. So it's nice to kind of meet like sort of people who are working, and you know, I'm just some fucking loser who just kind of happened to make this movie, got a lucky break and was able to make a movie. And you know, by the grace of God, I was able to kind of make something that was half decent. So, I feel pretty lucky just being able to kind of go to these places and kind of meet people and kind of being able to stand, with my chin up and kind of be like, yeah, you know, hell yeah. You know, we're both award-winning directors, you know, nice to meet you kind of thing. You know, it's a nice, nice feeling. It's good for the ego, you know?
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, during your very successful festival run, the film was picked up by Raven Banner, and kind of spinning forward, is there any current plans for like a kind of general release, whether it be cinemas or streaming, or is there anything in the works?
The film was actually picked up by Raven Banner way back in March, and at that once they have the rights, what they do is they go and they, sell it sort of territory by territory. The first attempt that is usually made is like to try to just sell it to give worldwide rights to some big buyer, like for example, Sony or something, right? But the sadness is just a little bit too spicy for Sony or Disney or whatever. So you end up just sort of selling it territory by territory. The major, like, you know, let's say six territories in the world have already been spoken for. We've already cut deals, and the film has been sold. So it absolutely will show up, on your, on whatever streaming service. Like, that's something that I actually can't say right now because it hasn't been announced yet. But rest assured, it will be available in the English speaking territory. All I'm trying to say is that the film will come out probably second quarter of next year on a well-known streaming service, but I just can't say which one yet. But one thing that I can say to anybody who's listening in Germany is that it has been announced that Cape Light has bought the film, and they're probably the first release that you see of The Sadness will come from Cape Light. So it'll be probably in terms of sort of the roadmap, the first official release of The Sadness will be a German release, and it'll be available on Blu-ray. But that kind of, isn't going to be very helpful because you got a Chinese language film with German dubbing or German subtitles, so it's probably not going to be very watchable to an English speaking audience. But despite that, that's probably going to be the first official release of The Sadness. It'll be released first in Germany.
Wow. Okay. I do know from the statistics, I do have a couple of German listeners. So for them, you can pick it up. You can pick it up early.
I'm kind of working with them right now too. They showed me kind of like what they're planning on doing for the release. They're doing it nice. And they're putting together a nice little package. So like a physical package. So hopefully that'll turn out nice. I'm looking forward to seeing what the final result is for that.
And, I look forward to whenever it comes out over here in New Zealand. Before we started recording, the phone going off everywhere.
hold on 1 second. Okay, this is some great podcast material. Hold on 1 second.
Yeah, no, I'll probably keep this in.
Yeah, what's up? Yeah, I know. I'm busy right now. I'm fine. I don't have COVID. Okay. I'm feeling okay. Okay. Yeah. Well, I'll just telling you right now that I'm fine. Okay. Bye bye. Yeah. That was the police.
Yeah. Okay.
They call you every day to make sure that you don't have COVID. And,
yes, I also was in a quarantine hotel in New Zealand, and they do the same thing. They give a daily health check. It's like, do you have a sore throat, runny nose, headache? Da-da. So they give, and it's just like, no, I don't have anything. It's fine. I'm fine.
Yeah.
It's okay.
You know, I mean, you heard me. I was being a little bit rude, but the only reason I was being rude is because they do it through text message, right? Like around noon, what they do is they send you a text message and they're like, if you have no symptoms, enter one. If you have these symptoms, enter two. If you have other symptoms, enter three. And I always just enter one. So I actually already answered them today. So I don't know why the fuck they actually have to call me and interrupt my valuable podcast.
I don't know. Me and my partner had a couple of situations like that where we're like, where are they? Like, so some days, come to our door or whatever, and then.
Oh, dude, did you get to quarantine with your girlfriend?
Yes, with my partner, yeah.
Oh, sorry, I with your partner, yeah. No, I just because that doesn't sound so bad. At least you have someone to talk to, and you guys can have a little intimate romantic vacation inside of your inside of your quarantine hotel, you know? I mean, me, I'm all by myself, you know?
Yeah,
I mean,
no, like, that's fair. Yeah, yeah. I mean, me and her, we're like, oh yeah, we're kind of working a lot, but like, yeah. but no, it was good. It was good having her. It was good. It was good. It was yeah. Definitely.
I mean, for sure. I mean, yeah.
Far preferable to being myself, you know, like,
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So what else? Do we have any more questions?
Oh yeah. No. So like I was just kind of bringing the interview in, bringing it towards a close. But, before, we started recording, you mentioned that you're currently writing something. Can you tell us anything about that?
Sure. It's another feature, first of all. Like I thought for a second that it might be a good idea to maybe focus on on maybe doing like some sort of serial, like a series or something. But it seems to me like doing another feature is the right thing to do. And basically, I want to make something that's has the same kind of like intensity and the same kind of sort of like focus on sort of special effects and action and just sort of overall sensation, like the kind of movie that you kind of watch with your heart instead of your brain. That's kind of how I feel about the sadness. The sadness is not like a you know, Inception or whatever, you know. It's like where you're trying to figure a bunch of stuff out. It's very much just about like moment to moment and sort of experiencing sensations. And so I want to do something like that. I think that that's kind of where my strengths lie. But the thing with the sadness is that it functions very much on sort of like the sort of the engine of the horror is cruelty and malice and intentionally harming other people and making them suffer. That's kind of like why the film is scary. So I'm gonna remove that engine and replace it with something like totally different and see if I can still have a movie that is scary, like is as scary, but sort of for different reasons, you know? And I know that this is very, very vague, but I guess I'll be a little more specific and just say that I want it to be a little bit more along the lines of like a monster movie, something a little more into the realm of the fantastic. So I'm really going to be pushing my special effects team a lot farther this time around, and also to the dismay of some sort of staunch horror fans out there, I'll also be kind of using probably more CG in this one as well. But trust me, I know how to use it properly.
Okay. Well, I'll take your word for it, Rob. CG doesn't always mean bad. It's just usually I think if you blend practical and CG, it can work beautifully.
There's actually quite a lot of CG in The Sadness. It's just sort of hard to tell because we did it kind of just like what you said. We combined a lot of the practical and the digital together. Like there's a lot of situations where we have blood, like spraying or dribbling out of wounds, and we have like tubes like painted out, or we have like, how do you say that? Like impacts happening on like stand-in limbs or heads, and then we replace the real heads later and stuff. Like there's a lot of sort of pretty clever tricks in The Sadness that are combinations of CG and digital. But this one is going to have more. This new idea is going to have a lot more just like straight up, like straight up CG stuff, like animated. Stuff. You'll see. It'll be cool. Hopefully it'll be cool.
Excellent. Okay. Well, I'll look forward to that as well then. Okay. Well, it's been great talking to you, Rob. Thanks very much for coming on New Horror Express. And please do come on again when you make that monster movie.
Yeah, man. I'll, like just, you got my email. Just give me a shout and we'll talk again.
That was my guest Rob there, who I'd like to thank once again for coming on the show. And as always, I'd like to thank you, listener, for tuning in to this latest episode of New Horror Express. Remember, if you like what you heard, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you find good podcasts. Plus, if you are reviewing, please make sure to give us 5 stars, as otherwise the algorithm thinks we are rubbish. And you wouldn't want that on your conscience, would you now? Anyway, that's all for this time, but be sure to join me next time, when I will have another great guest from the world of indie horror. Until then, though, see ya!